You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet.
And story is everything.
We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell.
And that was our opening music by the Hot Texas Swing Band, Hot Texas. And we thank them for giving that to us to be able to play at the beginning and the end of the show. And we're delighted that you're joining us again this week. Jim, who's our
guest?
Who's our guest this week?
Our guest tonight is Dan Batson.
And here he is. Hey, Dan.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome. We're delighted to have you with us.
And I'm delighted to be here.
We have a little bio here to read before we get started.
Okay.
Give our readers and listeners a little idea of who we're talking to. Okay, Dan is a lifelong resident of South Carolina. He's a retired United Methodist pastor who served churches in the state for 38 years. A graduate of Clemson University and Erskine Theological Seminary, he served as a probation, parole, and pardon agent for the state for several years before realizing that he could no longer resist the call to pastoral ministry. He had the pleasure of serving many different churches with a wonderful diversity of communities and parishioners. Even though he was a pastor, each church contributed to his spiritual growth and maturity as much as he did to theirs. With my book, Mourning, he says, I present remarkable people of faith I encountered while telling the story of how, after my wife's death, I completely lost my faith. God's hand of care and grace made it a miraculous resurrection of belief for him. Mourning is his testimony to the remarkable and real way in which God never gives up on anyone. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you.
Welcome, Dan.
Thank you for having me.
Where are you chatting with us tonight? Where's home?
Marietta, South Carolina, which is right at the mountains of South Carolina, upstate.
Right.
How big a town is that?
Very small. It's not even incorporated, so it never has been. I was brought up here. Then moved around the upstate, you know, serving churches, and then we came back here. So,
where's the nearest biggest city?
The big city closest to us is Greenville. Traveler's Rest is a very popular destination. Okay. It's between Greenville and Marietta, but Greenville is the third largest city in our state.
So. Very good.
So, Dan, when did you start writing?
I started writing in college, really. I'm sure I wrote some before then, but in college, I had some really great English professors, and they encouraged us to do all kind of projects and to write and be creative. And so I started dabbling in it then, not really knowing if it would be anything I'd be really interested in. So I started at that point.
And this is when you were in Clemson.
That's right.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And did you meet your first wife, Donna, there? Is that where you met?
Yes, we did. We met there. She was in the dorm next to me, and a group, we would go to church together, and we would meet at the bottom of the dorm, and then it's in the book, but we would walk to the church, Clemson United Methodist Church, and we would walk there. And so she would always be in the group, but for some reason, I didn't realize she was in the group, and I would always introduce myself to her, and finally she got sort of upset. And so the next time I was there, and I said, "Oh, and I'm Dan Batson." And she, before I could say that, she stuck out her hand and said, "I'm Donna Gaskell." held out to me. So then I realized, oh, I think I've seen you every time we've been going to church, and I've totally ignored her or something. And but then that was enough to get my attention. So worked well. So good for her.
The two of you really are like two peas in a pod. This is a memoir. And it's for our listeners who are also readers looking for something new to read. This is really a very heartfelt and touching and well-written story of Dan and Donna and their life together through various homes and professional career changes. And like any marriage, events that happen in their lives and how they maneuver through life's challenges. They always seem to maneuver like on point, though.
Yeah.
You're really pretty amazing.
we just thought alike. Just always have the, you know, one of us thought about something or came to a decision, we knew the other one would be right there in step with us.
Yeah.
It was interesting how that worked out.
How did your first date come about?
I think I just decided I would ask her out and just see what happened after she had done that. And then we started talking during the greeting time at the church. A lot of churches do that. She was sitting next to me, so I started talking to her then. And I said, now, what are you majoring in? She said, elementary education. And I said, well, what do you want to do? She said, I never want to get married. I never want to have children.
Yeah.
I moved to Kansas and live with my grandmother, and that's what I want to do. And I was sort of like, well, maybe I can change that. So then we started dating that next week.
And then how long after are you married?
We married when we finished, so it was probably a year or two after that.
Yeah.
We got married in 80.
Yeah, so. Okay, Mary, okay. And,
you know, she didn't say at first, you know, well, you can't even remember my name, Dan. I don't know if I want to go out with you or not.
Yeah. And who are you? They got down the aisle.
Really.
Who are you?
You could have said that, for sure. But.
Part of the time when one of your first jobs was with the South Carolina Parole Board, and that might be an abbreviation for its actual. How did you find that work, and what was that like for you?
Well, I was an agent first, and then the being on the board happened decades later, actually. But I was an agent, and my brother was an agent in Greenville County, and I was taking graduate courses at that time and working at Clemson University in the Career Services Office. And then I was in a class with this lady, and ended up she was the agent in charge of the Oconee County Probation Parole Office. And so she just looked at me one night. We were in class, and she said, are you interested in being an agent? I have an opening, and I know your brother. Yeah. If you're anything like him, I could use an agent. And I thought, I never thought about doing that. But it sort of appealed to me, and I thought, wow, that would be more money than working part-time job, and I could still get my graduate degree. So then I started applying and went to the police academy and did all that, and so became an agent and finished my master's degree too, which was nice, and then went there.
Mm-hmm. And what was Donna doing while you were, what was she doing at that
She time? Was an elementary school teacher, and she taught, and that was her desire for her entire life. That's what she wanted to do. She started as soon as she graduated, didn't have any trouble finding a position, and just ran with it from there. She just loved it.
Mm-hmm.
She always said that she wanted to go the schools where the teachers did not want to go. She wanted to go where there was challenges and where the students needed her heart and soul, you know, to help. So that was her passion, and she did it very well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that worked out okay for her then.
Yeah.
Okay. It did. It had a lot of frustrations because, you know, dealing with kids that have, you know, that don't see the importance of what they're doing in school. So it had frustrations, but that's what she wanted. She wanted to have a challenge to make a difference in the lives of others. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very good. She kind of got a little confused there and thought maybe she wasn't going to become a teacher because she didn't get a good enough grade on the test.
That was interesting.
Yeah. She didn't know that she had to add the two numbers together. And that was the first time I felt like the hero, you know. All I did was make a phone call, you know. Yeah, you have to see them together. She thought they were standalone, and she was so devastated, but it wasn't.
And then you kind of got the call, so they might say, to enter a seminary school and pursue a career as a minister. How did that all come about?
Well, I just kept fighting the call, fighting it. And I just kept thinking, I like being an agent. We had two agents in Oconee County at that time. And so it was just the two of us, and we would do all of it. And it was a challenging job, but I feel like I was making a difference in lots of people, trying to get them straightened up and so they could be productive in society and not in jail anymore and all this stuff. But I kept fighting it. So I finally went to my pastor and said, okay, I've been fighting the call to ministry, and I really think that means I'm not called. And he looked at me and said, the fact that you're fighting it is the best evidence that you are called. He said, if you weren't fighting it, then you probably weren't. And I said, that wasn't the answer I was looking for. He convinced me that. I did that. And then after that, it was like it was very obvious, even though I had to give up my job, of course, but still.
You had, I think, three seminary schools you were considering going to?
Right, Candler and Duke, and then Erskine. South Carolina does not have a United Methodist Seminary. Erskine is an Associated Reformed Presbyterian Seminary. So that was a possibility. But my pastor at the time wanted me to go to Emory or Duke. They're both United Methodist seminaries.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I tell in the book that when I went to Erskine, I was going to go interview with the deans of all three and make a decision. But when I went to Erskine and he said that prayer, it was obvious. I never went to Candler or Duke for an interview. I just stopped there. I felt like my search had come to an end. Mm-hmm. And it was marvelous, great experience. Three long years, but it was very good experience. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Very good. So out of the experiences that we've talked about so far, it gives a little bit more of your background, out comes this memoir. And it starts chapter one, which Jim has gone back to several times. And then, of course, much, much, much later in the book, it's almost reprinted verbatim. But chapter one is called Underwater. Tell us a little bit about mourning and what inspired it. And then start us off with why did you choose to start this memoir with that chapter titled Underwater?
Okay. The inspiration came from the fact that after Donna died and I'd seen her valiant efforts while she was dying of cancer, just, you know, 5 months of cancer, and all that she'd been through and how courageous she was and how strong she was through the whole thing. And then her whole life was just all about that. I knew that I felt that I had to write about her, especially since my faith had been destroyed in the process and then restored by God in a very direct and marvelous way that was unmistakably clear. God realized I sort of had a thick head. He had to get my attention, and he did. And so after that, I knew that I had to write. So I started writing. She died in March, the Ides of March, and then I started writing later that year, because I knew I had to get it down and write it. And then that became the basis of the book. And as I wrote the book, I realized that part of the theme was that I was underwater. I was in over my head with what was going on to my beloved, and that I couldn't do anything to stop it. Even the prayers of people around the world, literally praying for her, and that I was underwater, and I didn't think I'd ever see the light of morning again, much less take another breath of air again, because it was just so overwhelming for me. And then that became the basis. So I wanted the start of the book to show you the intensity of what was going to happen. And then after it happened, then that would be repeated to show exactly what was meant by that first chapter, short chapter of what it was. I was under the water and didn't think I'd ever see the light of day again. So.
Mm-hmm. It's a very compelling opening to the book. You're a young man and you're doing what a lot of kids do. You know, you're kind of testing your abilities to hold your breath. You're jumping in. It's not really a quarry, but I, as a reader, immediately, you know, I imagine this is like the opening of a NCIS and you're all going to be dead and they're going to come out to this, you know, quarry and they're going to be like, what happened here? You know, because nothing good ever happens in these beautiful but isolated kind of places. But you're a bit of like kids are at that age. You know, you're not, you don't think necessarily about the dangers. You're compelled by the excitement and the thrill and the nobody like dog double dared you, you know, but, and then I think we've all found ourselves in those kinds of situations and you've got your feet on the ground and you're now, am I going to be able to push myself up and get to the surface? And that's that exhilaration and scary that, you know, the thrill that comes with terror at the same time. And of course, when you tell us the story, basically, again, much later, if we missed it in the beginning of the book, and how it sets the book up, we certainly understand it when here you are as a mature adult dealing with something, like you say, you're just in over your head, and it makes no sense. And it's as scary as it can be, isn't it?
Yes. And as a kid, we thought it was fun to be scared. Right. As an adult, you know, what if
how long did it take you to write the book, Dan?
Oh, just 14 years. So I worked on it diligently for 14 years. So I laugh and say, I don't know how many other people took 14 years to write a book, but
a number of people do. That's not unusual.
It's really not unusual. We're going to hold that thought. We're going to take a very short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk in greater detail about mourning. Stay right where you are. We'll be right back. And Sam, if you're listening,
story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shops Bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com. Find books and CDs on the menu. Choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with the Writer, with special guest Dan Basson and his book, Mourning, which is a memoir.
And we're delighted to have you with us, Dan.
Thank you.
Do you want to ask the next question to get us?
We have one written down here. Something we write down somewhere, so we have it in the back of our mind. You know, every chapter is like a standalone short story. Your prose is very descriptive. The readers can see, hear, taste, and feel the landscapes, the emotion you describe. Would you like to share a story or two about you that you cover in the book? Like maybe the honeymoon on Jekyll Island.
The honeymoon on Jekyll Island. Or the azure moon on the gondola. Let's see. Oh, there's so many. But if there's, you know, one or two that you'd love to just tell us about, that would be great.
Oh, yeah. Well, the gondola ride, that was just so totally, it was just, even while we were doing it, it seemed unreal. Like, was this really happening? Because we were just driving, we'd come down from Pennsylvania to visit my brother. He was in school up there, and we were coming back home, and we just decided we would take a side road just to have something other than the interstates. And then the person at the gas station said, well, there's this hotel up there, and it looked abandoned and everything. And then it had that river running through this cave, and the person with the gondola, and then the lanterns, and the whole time, I mean, even now when I think about it, I go, did that really happen? You know, it was just so beautiful. And I've tried to find it, you know, go back. I don't have a name. I'm not even sure where it was, all that sort of stuff. But I can't seem to be able to find it. But, and it's probably gone by now because that was a long time ago. But it was just magical. And the blue and the azure and then how that plays into it later. So many things I felt like God was sort of pointing the way for us, or saying this is a part of your future in some way, because it was just so totally unreal. I'm sure, you know, a lot of people have had something happen and you sort of go, did that really happen? Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of those things where you wonder if it's so mystical, I guess.
Well, you know, listening to the way you describe it now, and as we read it in the book, you know, it makes you wonder, did that place exist to some degree? Yeah, or did it,
like
it disappear forever,
mist of Avalon,
you know?
Went away with the mist or something, you know, like that.
You know, you're talking about the two ladies there, and you go up there, and they're waiting for
it's
you.
It's like Helen was one of them, Helen. They're waiting, like, oh, you're here. We're so glad you're here. And, you know, you just wondered.
And I looked around to see if there was a telephone down there in that cave, because I wondered, how did she know we were coming, you know? It, you know, it's a little creepy, but it was so beautiful. It was just unbelievably beautiful. Yeah.
Well, you know, her great-grandfather built the hotel. We're talking about a long time ago, and these two women are still there, and I'm kind of feeling like there hasn't been anybody at that hotel in 20 years.
Yeah. It looked that way. Yeah. It looked like no one would stay there. You know, that sort of not abandoned, but abandoned look, you know, so it looked like nobody would. You wouldn't stay there over the night or something. But,
It's almost a story out of Twilight Zone, you know?
Yeah. Well, it is. There is a, but it's a, it could be creepy, but it's not. I think it's also kind of the way that you write it. You are a very painterly writer. Mm-hmm. And the way you describe, there's a lot of descriptions of nature in this book, as well as candlelight, but there's the moon and there's rivers and there's trees. Yeah. And you also, in that same chapter, you talk about being very interested in telephone poles, electric wires, transformers. Yeah. And you have this idea that you'd like to just go around and find these places and take pictures. And I thought, you know, I have read some other, some fiction books where odd things happen under power lines and, you know, some sort of urban fantasies or, you know, that you go in, suddenly you find yourself in another dimension because, you know, you're camped out under power lines. And so my first thought when I read that about your interest, I thought, are you sure that you two really want to go explore power lines?
I think it was my need to escape or something. And I thought you could travel all of the United States, because it seemed like even in our area, all the telephone poles were different. They would do different things with them and different wires and all this stuff. And I kept thinking, wouldn't it be fascinating to just go around the nation showing all the different styles of how they do telephone poles and, you know, write a book or have a photo book, like a coffee table book with telephone poles and wires and all that. And we'd probably sell one copy, but, you know, it would be just...
You might be surprised, Dan. That maybe should be another work that you get going. Or an anthology, and you ask people to submit stories about, you know, life with power lines. You could call it Power Lines. It almost sounds like it could be a sermon series.
Oh, that right. Well, it's been handy for me because at Lancaster, when I was serving there, First United Methodist Church in Lancaster, which is the church where Donna died, right outside our side entrance on the sidewalk, there was a telephone pole. And on the telephone pole was something that looked like a refrigerator. It was and it was just there. And so finally, I asked some of the trustees, I said, what is that thing? And they said, what are you talking about? I took them out there. They said, we never noticed that. And it was not too far overhead level. And so then we called the power company and they came out there and said, That should never have been put on the telephone box. One, it hasn't fallen and killed somebody. It was completely useless. So they came and took the thing down. And I said, it's only because I had an infatuation with telephone poles that I saw this thing.
Oh, that's interesting.
That was a good ending to it.
That's really interesting. This is a memoir, and you do take us through through your life. There are some times when there's been, like, you have your son, you adopt your son, Tyler, and then we get a few stories about him. But it's not that we have something from every year of your life together. Did you keep journals, or how did you decide? Was that part of the mystery of 14 years of writing, was to determine what to put in, what to keep out and such?
Exactly. That was the thing. I had to decide exactly what was most pertinent, because I could have put in a lot of things that really, I wanted everything somehow to point to the morning, you know, to point to the climax. And I there were a lot of things I could have added that didn't seem to fully fit that pattern. So I had to leave out a lot of things that, because, you know, every family has things that are meaningful that happen to them along the way and everything. But this book had a purpose.
There are, go ahead.
You know, I'm thinking about your ministry. We were talking the other night when we talked about writing your sermons. And maybe you could share again how long it takes you to do the sermons, and maybe you keep them from year to year, depending, and update them and that kind of thing. Yes. How does that work?
Well, it is, and I take it very seriously. And maybe it's because I'm, you know, not as talented as some people at delivering sermons, but I want my sermon to be well prepared. I want it to have points that interest me, because, you know, most people that are, you know, going to church every Sunday, they've heard about everything about the scriptures. You pick a scripture and they've heard sermons on it. So I always try to make it something unique so that they would go, oh, haven't thought about that or something. Otherwise, they just go to sleep, you know, because they've heard it all before, and they're faithful, but they still have heard it all before. So I always tried to give it that other look. What about this part of it, or that part of it? And that takes work. And I found it fascinating. Plus, you know, I love to write. So it's fun to come up with exactly what you wanted to say, and how you're going to present it, and the illustrations that were part of it, and making sure that those weren't repeated at the church or anything. And so all of so the writing, to me, that was a high calling of writing, was to write something about God's word that would affect people in a way that would bring them closer to God and help them understand more about their walk with God. Then that's the ultimate achievement of writing, in my opinion.
When you attended seminary, your instructors, how would they approach you writing a sermon? How would they instruct you to write the sermon, and maybe kind of what point did they want to make sure that you brought out?
Well, they would tell us right from the start, keep it simple. You know, you can get real highfalutin with sermons and everybody's sitting there going, what? You know, so keep it simple, keep it straight forward. They like the classic 3 points, you know, introduction, conclusion, sort of like the classic way in which you write an essay, sort of thing. And they said your 3 points should very much go together to make the thesis statement. The thing you said first, prove that with the 3 points, same sort of thing. So they use that formula, but they said, you know, keep it where people understand it, use illustrations to lift it so that you're not just bogged down in theology. And they were very, very helpful. Erskine was graded that way. I felt like it was a trade school almost. The professors had been preachers at one point or another, and they could say, this will work in your church. Don't do this. You know, like they'd always say, if you ever say, I'm the leader of this church, that means you're absolutely not the leader.
You're totally
bad.
Yeah, right. That's right.
So all these little things they told us were just magnificent, you know, to learn all that.
There's a section in the book, you don't do it throughout the entire book, but there's a section where you tell kind of a story, and then you ask the questions, why are you here? And what are you doing? And I, as a reader, every time, you know, I'm reading those questions, I have a sense that you're asking yourself those questions and you're going to now share with us your answers. But as a reader, it would make me stop and pause for a moment, and I would try to answer them for myself. Why am I here and what am I doing? Talk a little bit about what those questions mean to you.
Well, and it was funny because the church there, Zion, which was near Clemson, and they had Dutch doors opened up into a courtyard, and I loved having the Dutch doors open. The little dogs would run up there and put their paws up and look at me, and I always felt like they were saying, what are you doing? And you know, that sort of thing. They were so cute, and I never did learn where they came from and didn't know their names, but they would do it regularly, and then that would just make me think, what am I doing? Why am I here? Because the dogs are asking me that question, which makes me sound a little crazy, but still, that, you know, because that was my second appointment. I'd served my first appointment 3 years. I was at Zion serving, and I was asking myself, am I doing what I thought ministry is? Am I doing it effectively? Am I good at it? Or am I just fooling myself? So it would make me analyze and rethink and everything, which I think was beneficial. And then I started, in the book, I mentioned some of the episodes, just a few of things that happened that I thought were rather meaningful to me at the time. And so that helped me understand that's why I'm here and that's what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. So I was sort of like answering the dog's questions by saying, well, this is what I'm doing. And that made me feel, and I could have put in a whole bunch more of that, but you know, again, it was, everything was supposed to point to the end. So
there's one chapter, and I don't remember where it's at, it really impacted me because you were with a parishioner who was dying, and he had been quite influential in the community. Mm. He had been a very successful businessman with a huge heart. And you're with him, and you yourself are somewhat amazed because with his last moments, he's praying for everybody else. Out of the abundance and grace of his own heart, he's not thinking about himself at all in his final moments, which you could imagine is probably his whole life was like that. And I have found that many of these stories, as much as they were pointing to what you eventually get to, these are all really powerful vignettes that we can apply in our own lives. Looking at some of these stories and thinking about people we might know. There's that lovely one with the gal that was such a great businesswoman as a young woman in the 60s. And she's telling you that story about playing with the boys when she's a kid and they're all climbing pine trees. Oh my gosh, you're so descriptive. And they're like, well, swinging. Oh my goodness. But that whole story is another one. And I think, was it Alzheimer's that she was finally in her final days she was dealing with? Yeah. And I thought to myself, how many of us could take a moment and sit with someone and get their story? Like you got the stories of so many of your parishioners in this book.
And we learned that in seminary too, that when you're the pastor, people share with you their intimate part of who they are. And that's a sacred trust, you know, that you have. But it's a marvelous thing because they're telling you things that they would not tell just anyone. And it's amazing to hear the stories. I love people's stories. That's one of the reasons I love being in ministry, because you hear people's stories, and their stories are always amazing, because even if you're just living ordinary life, you have amazing things that happen to you, where you see God intersecting with your life. And so I love that. I thought that was always a powerful witness.
Mm-hmm. In what way would you say mourning is a testimony to your faith?
Just in the fact that I would never have thought that the death of my wife, who was an extremely faithful person, strong in her Christianity, and strong in her trust with God, that her death would destroy my faith. but it did. And so then God intervened, but God, I guess God said, well, I've got to intervene or he's not going to be a believer anymore, you know, not a person of the faith, which would make a really bad pastor. So I think that that part of it was very much a rude awakening for me, that her death would do that to me. And I'm sure she would have hated that it mm-hmm. happened in that way.
So. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there something you would like to read?
Yes, if I could. I don't think it's too long. It's the epilogue, and it's basically about my son's daughter, Summer Lynn. And my wife was Donna Lynn, so they named her Summer Lynn. But I'll read it if that's all right. Lavender sky at eventide, lavender ocean with quiet white cresting waves, lavender wet sand reflecting the colors of the sunset on the surface of the beach. My grandchild, Summer Lynn, not yet 2 years old, running ahead of me in a little turquoise swimming suit. I can barely hear her soft laughter. She giggles for no reason, except that she is running on wet lavender sand. Spies some birds, seagulls and sandpipers. They are the target of her fascination. And she takes off for them, laughing louder. The birds look confused as they see her approaching. They're not sure what to make of this pint-sized human who is determined to get as close as she can to where they are feeding. At the last moment, they jump a few inches out and over the wet sand and glide a few yards away before landing and starting their feeding once again. Summer Lynn, still laughing, stops and reaches out her hand and tries to grasp them with her fingers. She seems confused that they don't understand she only wants to touch them. Undaunted, she begins her journey up the beach toward the glowing high-rise buildings in the distance. She stops and looks at the gentle lavender waves and then decides the quest for the elusive birds must wait because now the water is calling her. She runs to the little waves and begins to startle me with her determination to continue out as far as she can. When she senses I am behind her, she turns her head and looks at me and then reaches out her arm and points back to the beach. When I do not move, she shakes her finger and arm. Message is clear. She knows I'm there to make sure she goes no farther into the ocean, and she is telling me I'm no longer needed. A wicked little wave rushes out of nowhere and knocks Summer Lynn off her feet. I quickly reach to pick her up, thinking our reverie by the sea has come to a tearful end, but she begins to laugh. Before I can help, she is picking herself up from the warm water and begins to dance in the waves, almost begging them to knock her down one more time. Her world is lavender, her sky, her waves, her sand, her time with the wind and the freedom of rejoicing and discovering her world are all lavender. I know this time is more precious than I can even imagine. I desire to keep it all just like this, a lavender world for a little girl, a lavender seaside with no cares, lavender laughter with no thought of tears. I ponder how I can contain these moments forever. The time passes too quickly. Lavender begins to dissolve to darkness. Summer Lynn would not want to live in the lavender world forever and could not even if I could preserve it for her. Her world, full of excitement and full of things that will cause pain, awaits her. Now I no longer wait alone for the sunrise. Now I have seen it. Now I want her to see it as well, to know the promise of many days filled with joy. I pray that all might see the golden light and know that their dark night has passed. Dear Lord, bless each of us with a life filled with lavender sunsets. In the evening, as the darkness becomes night, please keep us safe and strong. When the golden rays of your presence comes with the dawn, let us walk with you in the morning. Amen.
Very good.
And that was Dan Batson. He was reading the epilogue, the last pages of his memoir, Morning. Don't go away. We're going to be back in just one more moment after a word from our sponsor, Out West Shop.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. we round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer with special guest Dan Batson and his book,
Morning.
The Morning. A memoir.
Yes. Do you want to ask Dan some process questions? We have a little bit of time.
Process questions. When do you write?
I find that I have to set aside most of the time, like an afternoon or evening, something like that. I have to be disciplined about it or I'll never do it. So especially when I was writing morning, I had a set time when I would come here to this house. We weren't living here at the time. And I would write in the afternoon one time a week and try to get one segment finished so that I could move on to the next. So it was a little discipline that I did.
Now, I think you mentioned to us the other day that when you do your sermons, you write your sermons on Friday. Is that right?
Well, I don't wait till Friday because then I would be panicked. I'd be in the panic. I would write creative writing.
Creative writing.
I start my sermons on Monday.
All right.
And then I work on them all week. And then hopefully by Friday, I have it pretty well done. But if you ever find yourself, sometimes you have to do things on Saturday and you're going, then you're so nervous you can't write, you know, because Sunday's coming.
Do you write, do you use a computer or a tablet or are you handwriting? How do you write?
I write with the laptop, and I find that just works very well for me. I did start at first writing everything by hand, but then I realized I could do it just as easily. I didn't know if I could compose while I was doing that, but once I got used to it, that was much easier.
Mm-hmm. Is it the same with sermons, too? You do it on laptop?
No, interestingly, I don't. I write those out by hand.
You write those out.
Okay.
You know, it's interesting because when we've asked other authors, some will say, I'm still writing longhand. I don't want the mechanical between my brain and my heart and my fingers. And I don't want that. I don't want to be typing. And then others like you're sharing. So it's so interesting how all of you creative spirits approach how you capture the what you're working on. Do you have any tips for memoir writers?
Well, the one thing is to make sure you find your voice, because when I started, I for some reason felt like I had to do it like a journal to fill in all the gaps. And so I was doing that. And my wife, Renee, we've been married for 13 years. And I gave her some of the first ones to read. And she's an excellent editor and excellent critic. And she wasn't afraid to tell me, but she would say, I get what you're doing, but this is not you. You're writing like a journal. And I think you haven't found your voice. And so I kept trying and trying. And this went on for months, you know. And then finally I wrote one and she said, you found your voice. This is it.
That's it.
I realized that's what I needed to do. Mm-hmm. So at first I was trying to write it from Donna's perspective. And you know, I loved her and I knew her and I felt like I could, but then I realized that's really impossible. You really can't. It's too much fiction involved when you're trying to write from someone else's perspective. So I wrote it from my perspective, which is the only one that I can do.
Do you have a favorite place to write, and do you need it to be totally quiet, or do you like to go someplace with a lot of noise?
No, at this house, there was an old garage at the back, and so we turned it into my late wife wanted to turn it into a spare room, and so she designed it, and they finished it after her death, but that has become my writing spot. Because I roost out there and write, so I like it quiet and not too many distractions and all that. So, but you know, whatever works.
True, very true.
What's your next question?
Well, we have one here we didn't talk about the other night. Best investment in your literary career, not necessarily money, perhaps, but
I think the best investment was listening to what other people had to say, because I kept putting off writing. And I gave credit in my acknowledgments to Betty Hodges. She was the one who painted the picture of the front. And she she came by my office, you know, several months after Donna died, and we were talking about Donna and everything. And then she looked at me and she said, well, you know that you have your story. Now all you need to do is write it. She was a university English professor, and I was an English major. And so she just looked at me and said, you have your story. You just need to write it. And it was like somebody just slapped across the face. I realized that's exactly what I need to do. But I've been thinking about it, but I hadn't actually done it. And she was saying, do it.
What are you working on now?
I'm working now on a combination, a collection of all my sermon illustrations over 38 years that I've used from sermons. And I've kept them in computer databases. And I feel like these are stories, a lot of them that people have told me over 38 years. And I know that if I don't save them, they're gone forever when I die. So I just want to make a collection of them, because each story tells something that brings us closer to God. And that was the reason I used them in the illustration. Mm-hmm. So I think that they're entertaining, but also very pertinent to mm-hmm. what it is to live the Christian mm-hmm. life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Dan, stay with us. But our final question for you is, where can people find you, follow you, buy the book?
Okay. It's available on Amazon. It's also available on Parsons Porch, which is the publisher for the book. And then if people want to contact me, my email address is dbatson201@aol.com. I'm antique with AOL, but I still use it. It still works. So dbatson201@aol.com is fine. So if you have a question or if you can't find the book, give me an email. I'll be glad to help you.
Well, stay right where you are. We're going to do a little bit of a wrap. Yeah. Jim's got a couple of quotes. Do you want to do the quotes first, honey?
We can do the quotes first.
All right.
First quote is from the book, actually. And the quote is, weeping may linger for the night, but joy comes from the morning. This is from Psalm 30, verse 5. And now from somebody we may know, from John Wayne in the movie True Grit, courage is being scared to death, but saddling up anyway.
Oh, Donna had a lot of courage.
Yes. That was very apropos to this book.
And so did Dan, absolutely. Yeah. Our guest next week, we have two books. Our guest is Pat Waller. And the first book is an older book, and I can't wait to. We're going to read both these books, Pat. We'll be ready to talk about them next week. The first one is I Am Mrs. Jesse James, a novel. I can't wait to get into this. And the second book was recently released, The Rose of Washington Square, a novel of Rosie O'Neill, the creator of the Cupid doll. So you'll want to join us again next week, same time, 6 p.m. if you're Pacific time on LA Talk Radio, direct here on the LA Talk Radio Facebook page. Or you can always listen audio only, so you can multitask on the latalkradio.com website. And let's see, is there anything else that we want to be sure that we cover right now? Say thank you to Sam and LA Talk Radio.
And thanks to Dan. And we thank appreciate you to Dan being on tonight,
for being with us. And thank all of you
and
for riding along with us.
And remember, it's
always a great day out west. Happy reading.
You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.